morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 26th of June. A few things to tell you about. First, the first hour of our program today, the AMA has officially recognized obesity as a disease. We'll talk about what that means. Marion Nessel will be joining us momentarily, professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and professor of sociology at New York University. There are also interesting things down the road. You may be aware of this, that the FDA has been working on national menu labeling rules ever since the Affordable Care Act was signed into law. And if you haven't seen the menus, calorie counts will be posted next to all menu items, including a specific number for each available portion size, as well as add-ins and toppings. That's already been rolled out in a few places. How effective has it been? That is coming up. We're keeping our eyes on the Supreme Court this morning, and the Defense of Marriage Act has been ruled unconstitutional, struck down 5-4 by the Supreme Court. We have yet to hear about Proposition 8. We'll be covering that tomorrow during this time period. Yesterday's ruling concerned the Voting Rights Act, and we will be looking at that during a good chunk of next hour. So the Supreme Court's very busy. We'll be responding. They have yet to put down the ruling on Proposition 8, but that will be happening momentarily. We'll let you know what happens there. And again, full coverage tomorrow, so you can respond to that during our 9 to 10 o'clock hour. Is it the fifth thing I want to say, or the fourth, is that this show is moving times. I don't want Monday to come and you won't know what happened to us. We're here. We have the same show. We're just moving to afternoons. Talk of the Nation, unfortunately, is no longer going to happen as of tomorrow. It's their last show. Send them a message and tell them how wonderful you thought they were, if you thought they were wonderful. It's been a long-running show, and we hate to see it leave. We do a similar kind of program, which is one of the reasons we asked to move from 1 until 3, Monday through Thursday, On Point, which will now be live, will be heard during the 9 to 11 segment. All right, that's it for now. Here's our phone number for you to talk about obesity with Marion. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Nessel is the author of a number of books, including Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics and Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. And she is also the author of a forthcoming book, which we will talk to her about. She writes a lot of books. Professor Marion Nessel, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So how meaningful was it, and what did it mean for the AMA to officially recognize obesity as a disease?
Well, what it does is it makes treatment of obesity reimbursable. That's probably its most immediate impact. And I suppose the hope of the AMA was that doctors would start taking obesity as seriously as they take other conditions and work with patients to try to solve some of their problems around their weight. I don't know whether it makes any difference one way or the other, but if it changes doctors' behavior to patients, I think that's probably a good thing.
Mm-hmm. And when you say reimbursable, it would be for what? Special kinds of surgical treatments or for drugs? Are there drugs available now?
Oh, there are. They certainly don't work very well, and many of them have side effects that seem to do more harm than good. But there's always pressure on medicine to do drugs.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me about the historical perspective. Is obesity as a larger problem now as it ever has been in American society?
Oh, no question about it. It's become democratized. It used to be that obesity was something that was reserved for the rich, who had enough food around so that they could overeat it. As our food supply has become larger and more widely distributed and cheaper, there's this classic statistic that Americans spend less for food as a proportion of their income than any other country and any other country's population in the world. And it's not only because we're so rich, it's also because of an enormous number of federal policies that are designed to keep the cost of food as low as possible. You know, that policy has a lot of consequences, but one of them is that food is very cheap, therefore people can afford to buy large numbers of calories at very low cost. And those foods have to be sold, so the food industry goes to a lot of trouble to make sure that people are encouraged to eat as much as they possibly can.
How much more should we be paying for food? Twice as much?
Oh, I have no idea. There are countries that spend a third to a half of their income or more on food. I mean, it used to be that, that's what you worked for. You worked to eat. Now you work to have electronics and cars
right.
and gadgets and travel and do all those other wonderful things that we get to do. And we don't have to worry about food so much. And so it's very hard to argue against cheap food. It's very easy for somebody like me to argue about the consequences of the cheap food supply.
And then we have that huge problem of cheap junk food being available in large parts of the country, particularly Central City, because you can't get access to some of the healthier foods.
Right. That's, again, a political problem. All of these are political problems and are political decisions that are made by political leaders for political purposes. If there was one thing that I wish we could do would be to start considering agricultural policy as something that needs to be linked very tightly to health policy. But that's never happened. That's not what agricultural policy is about. At the moment, we don't have an agricultural policy because Congress was unable to pass a farm bill. But lots of people have been working to try to encourage Congress to consider the health implications of agricultural policy, particularly in light of the Health Care Reform Act that's been passed, that's coming into effect in a year or so, and the very serious health problems that people have in this country related to food.
Mm-hmm. What about that? How soon will it be before we see calorie counts posted next to all of the menu items?
Well, whenever the Office of Management and Budget lets the FDA release the rules. I don't know what's holding them up. I suspect that lobbying is holding them up, but that's because I'm very cynical about these things, I'm afraid. The law was passed when President Obama signed the Health Care Reform Act in 2010. That allowed the FDA, there was a little piece of it buried in the middle of that act, was something that put calorie labels on fast food menus, something that we've had in New York City since 2008. And the FDA immediately started writing rules for them, and it released its preliminary rules, but there was an enormous amount of industry pushback about them. And then they released more preliminary rules, and they had pulled back on requiring calorie labels in pizza places and movie theaters, where I think they're needed more than any place else. And now they're being held up at the White House Office of Management and Budget for reasons that I don't know.
Hmm. What about those fast food labels? How have they worked in New York? Are people staying away from high-caloric food?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. The research shows that on average it doesn't seem to make much difference. But I can tell you that it absolutely influences what I buy, without question. And my educated, well-off friends who go to these places also say that it influences them. They're just shocked to find out that a breakfast muffin is 700 calories.
Oh, my gosh. Is it really?
Well, some are. If they're big enough, they are.
Yeah.
And so they're not going to eat those things. Or they're going to order a half sandwich if they discover that the sandwich is 900 calories, which many are. But if you don't look at the labels, or you don't know what they mean, or you don't care about them, or you don't think about it, it's not going to change your behavior at all. And somehow the research is unable to pick up the difference in populations, because they're dealing with the overall averages. And unless they're, parsing out the different population groups, they're not going to pick that up. So in a way, calorie labeling is doing the most good for the people who need it the least.
Isn't it remarkable when you think about it, and you think about this all the time, that this activity that we do, that we need to do, that's so important for staying healthy and keeping us alive, is something we don't think about. What we eat, what we put in our mouths three times a day, usually more than three times a day.
Yeah, well, the best place to see where that disconnect comes in is in large portions. And I'm just fascinated by the effect of large portions on people's eating habits. There's now, if I had one, I sort of laugh about this, but it's true. If I had one thing that I could convey to the American public, it's that larger portions have more calories. No, I can't even say it with a straight face because it's so it's so intrinsically hilarious to even say something that's so obvious.
Right.
But the research shows over and over and over again that large portions have an influence on what people eat that you would never expect. First of all, people have no idea that larger portions have more calories, and we showed this at my university because I got the instructor of introductory class in nutrition to ask her class how many calories were in an 8-ounce serving of soft drink and how many were in a 64-ounce serving of soft drink. And these are people who got into a reasonably good college. They can multiply by 8, 8 to 64. And we didn't expect them to know how many calories were in a in an 8-ounce soda, it's 100, but we didn't expect them to know that particularly, but we certainly expected them to multiply by 8, whatever figure they guessed. In fact, the most common multiplier was 3. So they guessed that a 64-ounce soda had 300 calories. So I asked the instructor to go back and discuss this with the class and ask them, they're perfectly capable of multiplying by 8. So how come they multiplied by 3? And they said, absolutely. 800 calories in a soda is impossible.
Oh, my goodness.
It's not possible.
Oh.
We don't feel full when we drink it. We're drinking it because we're thirsty. It doesn't say 800 calories on the label. It says 100 calories on the label per serving. And they just didn't believe it. And so there's something incredible about it. And I think that must have to do with the results of the research that show that if you give somebody a larger portion of food, they will eat more calories from it than they would from a smaller portion. And if you ask them how many calories they ate, they will underestimate the number of calories they ate from a larger portion by a much, much greater fraction than from a smaller portion.
That's remarkable.
So there's something inherent about the way we relate to food, that's some human way that we relate to food that's intrinsically deceptive. And that's why I think large portions are a sufficient explanation for why people are gaining more weight than they should.
We welcome phone calls. Marion Nestle is our guest this hour. She has been considered a key voice in food policy, nutrition, food education in this country for a long, long time. And she continually writes important and best-selling books on food, including Why Calories Count, which is what she was just talking about, From Science to Politics, Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. Our conversation, prompted by the AMA officially recognizing obesity as a disease. Is that a good thing? What does it do for the obesity rates in this country? Why are they so high? Why we don't pay very much attention to the calories that are in our food? At least many of us don't. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. One line is open if you would like to get it. It is yours. Our phone number, our email, let me give you that as well, is talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, we have a two-part show. Yesterday, the Supreme Court struck down Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act. We'll be talking about that and how some states are already responding to that. Jamie Floyd will join us, broadcast journalist and legal analyst for cable and network news. This hour, the Supreme Court did just strike down Defense of Marriage Act as unconstitutional, 5-4 vote, and we're awaiting word on Proposition 8. We'll be digesting the ruling today, and tomorrow during our 9 o'clock hour, we'll be talking about today's ruling in great detail from 9 until 10. Marion Nessel is with us this hour. Food is what we're talking about. Obesity now classified as a disease, and we're looking at the issue of food in America and why so many people are heavy and why we don't think about what we eat. And welcoming phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. B is our first caller. Hi, B.
Hi. Thank you for this opportunity. I'm really interested in this. You know, calories aren't created equal. 500 calories of a chocolate chip cookie are not the same as 500 calories of broccoli. But, you know, cheap food isn't good and good food isn't cheap. So it's so much easier and cheaper to do the non-nutritious, easy food than it is to take time to cook, and people don't cook anymore.
Marion.
I wish they would. You can eat much more healthfully if you cook your own food, and even if you don't have a lot of money, you can cook more healthfully if you cook your own food. But, of course, that means that you have to know how to cook. Mm-hmm. You have to have the opportunity to cook, which means you need enough time to shop. You have to have food available to cook. And all of these things are very, very complicated and difficult for people who are working lots of jobs and many hours. But I think you've raised just a critically important point, which is, why is healthy food more expensive? And that has to do with federal policy that has, in which our political leaders have decided that the cost of some foods are going to be subsidized and the cost of other foods are not. And right now, fruits and vegetables, which is what we want everybody to be eating, are not subsidized, and there's no price break for them. So if they appear to be very expensive, it's because they are relative to other kinds of foods. Department of Commerce has published this index, the sort of indexes of what's happened to the index price of fruits and vegetables since 1980. And they've gone up by about 40%, whereas the index price of sodas and various kinds of junk foods has gone down by 30 to 40%.
Goodness.
So, yeah, there's a reason why people think that fruits and vegetables are expensive. They are.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, I was reading about your aha moment with beans yesterday, that you talked about your mom being an adequate cook, but I think you had string beans out of a can. And I can't remember where you were, but you tasted a bean right off the vine and you just thought it was delicious.
Well, it was, I was very young. I was at summer camp. And I went to a summer camp that was a small one that was run by a fabulous cook, a really tremendous cook. I mean, I had never eaten food like that before. And if you were a good camper, she would send you out to the huge vegetable garden. This is in southern Vermont. And you could pick the vegetables for dinner. And so, you know, one for the pot and two for me, kind of thing. And I remember, I mean, I'll just never forget it. It was this transforming experience where I had had canned green beans before, but I had never seen one that was growing on a vine. And I picked this thing. It was a hot July day. And it was warm from the sun. And I bit into it, and it was sweet.
Mm.
I mean, I didn't know beans were sweet or had this wonderful, crunchy flavor. And I've never looked back. I mean, that was, this is the way food is supposed to
that
taste. Like,
it.
Okay, I get it.
Yeah.
You know, and then I lived in New York City, where at the time we didn't have access to the kind of food we have in New York City now. And even so, I'm just back from California, and oh, those people are so spoiled.
Thanks, B, very much for your call. Dave is next in Beloit. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how you doing?
All right,
just
Dave.
A quick, very quick background to my question. I'm a truck driver for a major snack food company, and 13 years ago, I was 45 pounds heavier than I am now, and I'm perplexed that my peers, a lot of them, will ask me how I stay so slim. We do. have a physically demanding job. We'll spend hours unloading a truck, a couple thousand cases, 15,000 pounds of product. And but somehow they don't seem to understand that hard work doesn't equate to carte blanche for eat whatever you want then, and you shouldn't gain weight. And I guess they don't understand why they're not getting it. If you could speak to that, I'd appreciate it.
Thanks, Dave.
Well, I don't think it's intuitively obvious that you don't spend many calories when you're doing hard work. You know, the people who have studied these kinds of things really carefully, and there have been many, many studies, come up with what I think are really disappointing numbers. So that, for example, running a marathon spends about 3,000 calories and for many people, that's a pound. That's not very much weight to lose for running 26 miles. And it's really disappointing to see how little energy is expended in doing what feels like very, very hard work or very long work. So exercise and activity and hard work are really, really important for maintaining health, but they're not very helpful for, and they're helpful for calorie balance, but not nearly as helpful as you want them to be. It is much, much easier to overeat calories than it is to overspend them. Now, I know there are exceptions, and there are people who exercise all day long and can't eat enough to keep themselves in weight balance. But for most of us mere mortals, it's really easier to overeat than it is to overexpend.
Thanks, Dave, for the call. Lori in Port Washington, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have long followed Dr. Nestle's advocacy work on behalf of good foods. But I do have a couple questions. First, I'm reading a book by Dr. Robert Lustig called Fat Chance, which talks about the correlation of obesity to disease, not the causation. So I'm interested in how you would look at the new ruling in relation to that scientific look at obesity and disease. And then the second part of that is when you were talking about 64-ounce sodas that are available to people and having it be a choice, there is a tendency to blame people for obesity. And I'm just wondering if Dr. Lusty's scientific work is correct, what role hormones and the types of foods that have been made available to citizens have in that relationship. Thank you.
Thanks, Lori.
Ooh, complicated question. First of all, I love Robert Lustig, and I love his book. He's really, really fun. And if you can read his book and get through the science part, there's really a lot to be learned there. His major thesis is that eating too much sugar changes hormonal balance and leads to obesity. I'm not convinced that anybody has been able to produce a study that distinguishes between calories and where the calories come from. The one study that did that didn't show any difference at all in weight loss between one kind of diet and another, as long as the calories were maintained the same. But that's only one study. These studies are very, very hard to do and expensive. So I'm not totally convinced that sugars, rather than the calories that the sugars bring, make the difference. But I think everybody would be healthier eating less sugar. There's no question about that. Sugars of any form. And if you ask, if you read the book carefully, he carefully distinguishes, and you have to read it carefully to see it because it's kind of buried, but he carefully distinguishes between quantity and quality so that, you know, a little sugar doesn't hurt anybody, but a lot of sugar can change metabolism and change the way metabolism works and make it easier to put on weight. That's a complicated answer, but I think the metabolic issues are complicated.
We still have a lot to learn about all of it, don't we? We need definitive studies, or are those virtually impossible?
Well, they may be impossible to do, in part because, or very difficult to do, in part because people are so complicated to study. We're just not very good experimental animals. And the best studies are the ones that are where people are put in or the clearest studies, I should say, are the ones where people are put in metabolic wards and basically imprisoned during the course of the study so that exactly what they eat and exactly what they do can be measured. Otherwise, you're depending on people's self-report of what they eat, and everybody lies, or either consciously or unconsciously. We're not very good reporters about what we eat.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the studies are enormously, these questions are enormously intellectually challenging.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm so interested in it. It's so hard to get definitive answers, and you have to develop a tolerance for what I call grays, as opposed to blacks and whites.
Right.
The diets are complicated. People are complicated. Behavior is complicated. To me, that's what makes it interesting.
I'm wondering about habits that we get when we're very young. My dad, Marion, was a sugar broker, and I used to go with him on Saturday mornings to the A&P and the IGA with the cotton candy machine, and he allowed me to make the cotton candy. You know, we'd give it out to people at the grocery store.
Oh, what fun.
But I ate so much cotton candy, and to this day, I really like sweets. I could help myself. I could be more disciplined about this. But I wonder how much of that is ingrained early on, so that if you develop that real sweet tooth, or, you know, if you develop some kind of craving for a certain kind of food early in your life, what does it do to your body, and is it very, very difficult to change your patterns?
Well, I think the answer to that is gray, too, yes and no.
Mm.
There's certainly plenty of evidence that people can change their dietary habits and develop completely new dietary habits as they get older. It's one of the things that happens when people go from being adolescent to being adults. Everybody is born with a taste for sugar. That has great survival value because breast milk is sweet. And it's, you know, the people who look at these evolutionary things say that it has enormous survival value. It encourages babies to want to eat, and they're not going to survive if they don't. So lots of people like sweets, and I like sweets. I think sugar is one of the greatest inventions in the world.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear you say that.
And it has its place.
Yes.
And I absolutely believe it has its place in healthy diets. You know, I try not to drink mine, because I don't think that's a particularly healthy way to get your sugar.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, even Robert Lustig says you can have 50 to 100 grams of sugar a day, which is the amount in one or two 16-ounce sodas, and it's roughly 10 to 20% of calories, which is what health officials have been saying for years is really okay and you can live with it. It's when it gets above that it starts causing problems that people have a hard time dealing with.
Right.
And bodies weren't meant to have that much sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And they certainly weren't meant to have it in liquid form,
mm-hmm.
where it goes in very quickly.
Lori, thanks so much for your call. Christopher in Hazelhurst, hi.
Yes, hi. I had a question for Dr. Nessel. I'm a physician in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area in a large HMO. We utilize the electronic medical record. And I'm struck that many of my colleagues who are good physicians won't put obesity in the problem list, and yet they have many of the other illnesses that are consequences of obesity, such as high blood pressure, heart disease, et cetera, in the problem list. Has she noticed a reluctance of physicians to discuss the problem? Thank you.
Well, I think there are two responses to that. One is that there's a lot of research that shows that physicians don't like to talk to patients about their weight. And when you ask them why, it's because they feel like they can't do anything about it, and they have nothing to offer the patients. There aren't any reasonable drugs. You can tell people to eat a healthy diet and exercise, and you know that nobody's going to do it because it's hard to do that in this society. The other part of it has to do with reimbursement for, and you're going to know more about this than I am, what gets reimbursed and what doesn't get reimbursed. And I think that's one of the that's part of the rationale for the AMA's decision about calling obesity a disease, is to make it easier to get reimbursed for dealing with patients about these kinds of issues.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Christopher, very much for the call. Let's go next to Anne in Kenosha. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I wanted to get back to the guest's point about portion sizes.
Mm-hmm.
I was dismayed when Mayor Bloomberg caught so much flack and there were all those comments about the nanny state, et cetera, because people will eat as much as you put in front of them, especially if they're trying to get their money's worth. And
right,
if they,
right.
They feel economically challenged.
Mm-hmm.
They feel as though they're empowered by their ability to eat a lot. It makes them feel as though they're succeeding, that their money is, you know, it's going really far. And it's very hard to turn off that psychological need to get a deal or to eat everything in front of you because you paid for it.
I think you're absolutely right, Anne. Dr. Hassel?
Oh, I do, too.
Right.
I do, too. I mean, I live in New York City, and I've followed the drama of the soda cap with fascinated interest at the extraordinary intensity of the reaction against the idea that you could only be served a 16-ounce soda. A 16-ounce soda is two standard Department of Agriculture servings. It's not one, it's two. And it has exactly the amount of sugar in it that Robert Lustig starts worrying about. It's 50 grams of sugar in one 16-ounce soda. It's plenty. And sodas used to be 8 ounces. You know, they used to be much, much smaller. And they've gotten bigger because everybody loves a bargain. And because the cost of the basic ingredients in sodas is so low, the soda industry discovered that they could give people big portions and people would love them and they would still make a profit on them.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the 16-ounce soda idea was a very good one. If people wanted more, they were perfectly free to order more. And it wasn't that these were going to be banned or eliminated or anything like that, but they were interpreted very widely as being the government going way too far. When, in fact, what I think the Bloomberg administration was trying to do was to help people live in a food environment that makes it easier to make healthful choices.
And thanks very much for the call. We've been keeping our eye on the Supreme Court this morning. As you know, they had two major cases, Defense of Marriage and Proposition 8. This has just happened. Same-sex marriage is once again legal in California. The Supreme Court ruled Proposition 8 proponents did not have legal standing to appeal. They dismissed a closely watched appeal over same-sex marriage on jurisdictional grounds, ruling today private parties do not have standing to defend California's voter-approved ballot measure barring gay and lesbian couples from state-sanctioned wedlock. The ruling permits same-sex couples in California to marry legally. And also the Supreme Court earlier this morning struck down a key provision of the Defense of Marriage Act, paving the way for same-sex married couples to receive benefits. Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote the majority opinion that the Defense of Marriage Act violates the U.S. Constitution's guarantee of equal protection. The federal statute is invalid for no legitimate purpose, overcomes the purpose and effect to disparage and to injure those whom the state, by its marriage laws, sought to protect in personhood and dignity. He's often the swing vote in close decisions. He also said the law imposes a stigma upon all who enter into same-sex marriages made lawful by the unquestioned authority of the states. That decision was 5-4. I'm not sure what the decision was in Proposition 8, but we will let you know. And we're going to have full coverage of this tomorrow. It's a major decision by the Supreme Court tomorrow during our 9 o'clock hour. Yesterday, there was a great deal of discussion about the Supreme Court decision in striking down Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act. We will talk about that for a good portion of the next hour of our show. We got a lot going on. Professor Marion Nessel is our guest this hour, professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, Public Health, and professor of Sociology at New York University, author of a number of books, including Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics, Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. And she is gearing up for publication of Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics, which should be released in September. Here's our phone number. Anne, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to brunch, right? Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just a reminder that this show, same show, moving to a different time, starting Monday, July 1st, which will actually mark 20 years since I've been with Wisconsin Public Radio. This program, it'll be the same. We'll even have All Things Political Monday, but at 1 o'clock until 3 instead of 9 to 11. On Point, we'll move to these hours, Monday through Thursday, that show out of Boston. You can now hear it live, so you'll be able to call into that show live. And 45 North will be on Fridays from 9 to 11. And Science Friday will be on Fridays from 1 until 3. So some changes. Go to WPR.org for more information about other changes here on the Ideas Network. Marion Nestle is with us now. We were talking about Proposition 8. It was, again, a 5-4 vote. Roberts was joined in the majority opinion by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Antonin Scalia, Stephen Breyer, and Elena Kagan. Justice Anthony Kennedy filed a dissenting opinion that was joined by Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and Sonia Sotomayor. All right, two phone calls, more of them now. Rita in Madison. Hello, Rita.
Hi.
Hi.
I wondered, I just saw an article in the New York Times which kind of blew me away, reading nutrition out of food.
And we can't hear you very well, if you can speak up a little.
I'm sorry. There's an article in the New York Times, you probably saw it, reading nutrition out of food, and all the common foods we eat seem to be the ones that have no nutrition in them, you know, white potato, the sweet corn, the apples, the everything. And I wondered if you could talk about that in relationship to GMOs and how we don't talk about that. It just seems like our food is changing so much with Monsanto and the farm bill that supports all this and the money. It's just so tied together. It's very upsetting.
Professor Nestle?
I actually couldn't hear it. I couldn't hear the question.
I'm sorry. She wanted to know about all of the common foods that we eat that don't seem to have any nutritional value whatsoever. She mentioned white potatoes. She mentioned apples. She mentioned sweet corn, and wanted to know about the relationship with the farm bill in subsidizing certain kinds of crops that really don't have any nutritional value at all.
Yeah, I think to say that these foods don't have nutritional value is misunderstanding. What I did hear was something about the New York Times, and so I'm assuming that the caller is referring to the big article in the New York Times a few weeks ago that talked about how the varieties of foods that are being produced now in our industrial agriculture system are different from the varieties of foods that used to be available years and years ago, and that the level of antioxidants in those earlier versions of the foods were much higher than in the foods that we're eating now. Antioxidants are not essential in the human diet. The article actually didn't talk about the nutritional value of the current foods, and they have plenty of nutritional value. What they don't have is these unusual bitter-tasting antioxidants that have been bred out of them because they didn't taste good. And we think that antioxidants are very important for health, but we don't really know how or why. And there are hundreds of them, literally hundreds of them, in fruits and vegetables. We assume that they have value for human health, but we really don't know what it is. It's not something that I'm very worried about right now. There's very little evidence that Americans are nutritionally deprived. The big problem with the American diet is that people are eating too much. So it's not something that's high on my agenda for worry until we know a lot more about what those antioxidants are doing.
Well, you think of the enormous amount of money that people who make vitamins and people who are touting certain kinds of food are making off antioxidants, just to name one thing. it's a huge industry. People are making a bundle, and it seems to me from what you've said this hour that we don't know if what they're saying is right.
Well, we don't really know what the antioxidants do. I mean, we know they get rid of, that some of them get rid of toxic things in the body, but we don't know whether that's good, bad, or indifferent because the body's detoxification systems are very, very complicated. And some of these compounds were there to protect the plants against insect pests. And we don't know what their effect is on us.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm not seeing much evidence that most Americans are antioxidant deprived. If anything, we're taking in far too many of the antioxidant vitamins than we need. It's just not something that's high on my list of things I worry about. There may be other people who are very worried about it, and there's no question that the promotion of antioxidants sells foods. I mean, I've had some of my favorite cereal boxes had big immunity claims on the front with big antioxidant thing on it, as if eating that cereal with antioxidants is going to make you healthier. I'm not aware that that's the case. Everybody's healthier eating fruits and vegetables, that we know.
Mm-hmm.
And they contain lots and lots of chemical compounds, that we know. What we don't know is what they all do.
Hmm. Dia in Burlington, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I think that as Americans, we should be more aware of when we're raising our children, allowing them to develop the innate sense of when they are hungry and when they are full. In addition to giving them too many processed foods and too many snacks, at mealtimes, I think allowing the child to decide, you know, I've had enough. And I remember when I was raising my kids, I would watch T. Barry Brazelton, a pediatrician on television. And he showed, like, what, you know, he was talking about picky eaters, and he showed what they could subsist on, and I was blown away. He said if they drank, like, a school lunch milk container and a couple of green beans and a half a piece of buttered bread in a day, they'll be fine, and they'll probably make up for it in the days ahead. But because we're always satisfying them whatever their need might be, we give them food, we're not letting them develop, you know, that knowledge that, oh, I'm hungry now. And they may be willing to try more unprocessed foods if we let them get to that state before we feed them.
Hmm. Marion?
Yeah, I talk to lots of people who have no idea what the sensation of hunger feels like. And it seems to me it's useful to know what it feels like so you recognize it when it's there. Being very hungry is not a very pleasant sensation, and it's certainly not something that you want to promote, but having kids ready to eat before dinner seems like a really good idea. I attribute a lot of this to the enormous effort of the food industry to market junk foods to kids, and that marketing is designed very directly to do three things. It's to make kids want certain products by brand name, excuse me, to pester their parents for those brand name products. But even more than that, and I think this is what the caller was referring to, even more of that was to make kids think that they know what they're supposed to be eating more than their parents do, that they're supposed to be eating kids' foods, products that come with cartoons on the packages and are linked to TV programs and that kind of thing. And what that has created is generations of kids who believe that they are in charge of what they're supposed to be eating rather than their parents. And for parents who care about what their kids are eating, they're fighting the food industry every time they talk to their kids about food. I don't think that's fair.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I think that marketing to children is something that everybody ought to be really concerned about.
Thanks, Dia, very much for the call. We're going to check on your phone because it's getting a little rattly, so I don't want you to disappear in the middle of the conversation. Hour two of our program on this Wednesday, we are going to be talking about the Supreme Court's decision striking down Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, which took place yesterday. The provision, as you probably know by now, designates which parts of the country, and it mostly has been southern states, must have changes to their voting laws cleared by the federal government or in federal court. That will no longer be the case. Supreme Court is really putting it back on Congress, and there's some question as to whether or not Congress has the political will to look again at the map where voting laws may be discriminatory and if it needs to be changed because it's out of date. What this means and what some states have already done as a result of this Supreme Court decision will be part of our conversation. Lewis Black will also join us. Mr. Black's going to be at Summerfest, which opens today here in Milwaukee, and he will be with us to talk about comedy and graduations and staying positive and the importance of humor and all of that. Okay, let's go back to phone calls. Mike is next in Columbia County. Hi, Mike.
Hey, I'm on a cell phone, so if I get cut off, I apologize.
All right, Mike.
I want to go back to the nutrition and that sort of thing a little bit. I just want to mention that my paternal grandparents, Grandpa was fairly tall and skinny. Grandma was short and kind of wide. They were both. And turns out my uncles all looked like Grandma, and my aunt looked like Grandpa. Hmm. And it's continuing in the family now, only it's more diverse. A bunch of us are short and heavy, and a bunch of us are fairly tall and thin. What's up with that?
All right, what's up with that, Marion?
Genetics. Genetics is a big factor in human appearance, growth, health, and behavior. And it's certainly something that needs to be taken into consideration in diet and everything else.
If you wanted to lose 30 pounds, if you had to lose 30 pounds, if you were if it was recommended that you do so, what advice would you give?
Oh, eat less.
Eat less.
Yeah, it's really as simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
When my book, What to Eat, came out in 2006, I didn't write it as a diet book. It's a book about food issues.
Mm-hmm.
Situated in supermarkets, and I went around a supermarket and talked about every issue I could think of in every section of the supermarket. And to my enormous surprise, people came up to me afterwards and said, I read your book and I lost 20 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
I read your book and I lost 50 pounds. The record was 90. I read your book and I lost 90 pounds.
Oh.
And I hadn't written it as a diet book, not at all. And yet people said, I didn't know that that was the way you were supposed to eat. I didn't know you were supposed to eat this food, these foods, and not those foods. And I just thought, oh, okay, I'll start following your advice about supermarkets, and I lost all this weight. It's that easy.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not that difficult. You just have to eat less.
Well, you need to write that book. You can make yourself some money.
I know, but
you need to write that book and market that book as a diet book.
Oh, I'm an academic. We're not allowed to do those things.
You'd make some money, no doubt about it. I can't believe how much.
No, we're not allowed to make money. I'm sorry.
Yeah. A lot of people have, haven't they?
They have, and they usually do it by jumping the data, which I'm also not allowed to do.
Yeah.
So.
Thanks, Mike, very much for your call. And let's go to Andrea, getting short on time, everybody, in Wonder Lake. Hi, Andrea.
Good morning. I think it's not just a matter of eating less, but of moving more. And if we look at how our society has changed from the aspect of physical activity, I mean, it isn't very hard to see that we've gone from an agrarian society to what we are now, which is a lot of sitting, an awful lot of sitting. And I find from personal experience that eating less is sometimes hard. Eating different foods and being trained to eat different foods is not so difficult. Just eating less can be very, very difficult. But when I am, and I have experienced the sensation of hunger, but it happens after I've really been doing something physical. So it seems to me, maybe I'm not seeing the population as a whole, but it is encouraging that our younger people today seem to be more into physical activity again, and I wondered what your guess is.
Okay, Dr. Nessel?
Yeah, it's interesting about that. It's intuitively obvious that people are less active than they used to be. But if you look at the data, from the time people started to gain weight, and you can date that pretty precisely to the early 1980s, After the early 1980s, rates of obesity in the United States started to go up very dramatically. Before that, they had been the same for decades.
Hmm.
And what changed was not physical activity. At least that's what the research shows. Very little change in physical activity since 1980, but plenty of evidence that people are eating more. But I thought that the caller made one really important point, that for many people, eating less is very, very difficult, but eating less of certain things is easier.
Right.
So if you change the way you eat and try to emphasize healthy, you want to not only eat less, but you want to eat better. And you have to do both at once. And I'm greatly in favor of physical activity, don't get me wrong. But from a weight standpoint, it's easier to change the dietary piece, because that's the piece that increased.
Please join us when the new book is out, and thank you so much, Marion Nestle, for being with us. Marion Nestle, professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, professor of sociology at NYU. Her book, Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics, will be coming out in September, and she's written many others. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and we have great conversations ahead, so please join us after we hear the latest news.